I first started running about 15 years ago as a way to quit smoking. Back then, my running clothes were very Rocky Balboa. So sweatpants, sweatshirt. Anyone who goes hiking or trail running knows that it's a lot easier and a lot more fun when you're wearing the right gear. Jonji makes performance apparel that'll take you farther on your runs and hikes. They have this merino wool hoodie that I wore on multiple trail runs this weekend. It's soft, it's warm, and most importantly, it does not get stinky when you get stinky. Another reason to love Jonji is that they donate 2% of all sales towards clean water projects, raising nearly $1 million so far. Head to jonji.com to find your new favorite trail wear, outdoors accessories, and essentials. And use the code OUTSIDE for 10% off at jonji.com. That's JANJI.com with the code OUTSIDE for 10% off. When I was a little kid, my whole family, grandparents included, packed into a Dodge Caravan and went on a 2-week road trip to Wyoming. We saw the rodeo in Cody, a grizzly bear in Yellowstone National Park, and an epic thunderstorm near Devil's Tower. On that trip, I fell in love with the West and the natural world. This might sound cheesy, but it kind of made me who I am today. Wyoming has it all. Breathtaking hikes, kid-friendly museums, two of the coolest national parks in the country. The truth lies west. Discover yours at travelwyoming.com.
I live by routines, especially my same-day delivery routine with Shipt. Because when Sunday rolls around, I'm not scared. I got my shopper on the way with all my favorites. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com.
Justine, are you recording?
Yes.
Would you ever live in New York City?
Ooh, an eternal question. I would like to say yes. I feel like there's this idea that you should move to the country when you're retired. But I wonder if you should move to New York City when you're retired because it's easier to get public transit. It's more walkable than a lot of parts of America. A lot of stuff going on, a lot of interaction. You can go sit at the bar pretty quickly.
I once heard an anecdote that the average New Yorker walks somewhere between like 2.5 to 4.5 miles a day, which I think is so cool. Because it is such a walkable city.
I love New York.
Yeah, it's a magical place.
And this actually brings me to a question we recently got from a listener on the Outside In Instagram. Ethan reached out to ask,
what would New York City look like in 50 years if everyone left today and stayed out?
Oh. I can imagine lots of pigeons, and then lots of peregrine falcons, because I know there are falcons that live way high up in the buildings, and just this really cool ecosystem.
The ecology of the skies, yes.
Yeah.
We are not the first people to think about this question. This is the subject of a book called The World Without Us by Alan Weisman, which came out in 2007.
Okay.
And Weisman took this question super seriously and interviewed, you know, paleontologists, biologists, astrophysicists, even Buddhist monks, to try to understand what a post-human Earth would look like. And he also specifically focused on this question of what would happen to New York in a hypothetical future without humans. But to do it, he looked at New York City's past. Have you ever heard of something called the Manhattan Project?
The Manhattan Project?
I think that maybe they were doing a little reference there, but no, it's the Lenape word for the island of Manhattan, Manahata.
Oh, that's where it came from. Okay, cool.
Yeah, so it means island of many hills. And it's this attempt to demonstrate what the island of Manahata looked like before Europeans got there.
Yeah, what did it look like?
Well, to paint this picture, they looked at historical maps, modern surveying, soil cores, tree ring data, all kinds of things. And were able to make these really educated guesses that like the Upper West Side was a forest or Times Square was a red maple swamp, probably created by beavers.
Cool.
The Lenape manage the island with fire and they have a whole fire map of the island. They know that the Lenape grew ceremonial tobacco where Washington Square Park is.
Wow.
And a big takeaway from this project for me was that underneath all the pavement and all the buildings and the concrete, New York is a very, very watery place.
Right.
There are so many streams and bogs and springs that existed and in many cases still exist underneath the city. So, to go back to our question of what would happen if humans just disappeared, the first thing that would happen is that the subway would flood.
Yes, which already happens every time there's a major flooding event, right?
Yes.
That's the thing you see on the news is just tons of water pouring into the subways.
The steel columns that support streets above the subways would corrode and buckle. So avenues would cave in and become streams and maybe even rivers. Pipes would burst when they froze. Buildings would flood. Windows would shatter. Weissman writes, as the freeze-thaw cycle moves indoors, things would seriously deteriorate.
Can you imagine the mosquitoes
there
in the summertime? All that just standing water from broken pipes and everything else? There'd be so many mosquitoes.
But also, there are all these animals that live both as pets and in zoos that are totally introduced. Like, do you know about Flacco, the Eurasian eagle owl?
No.
Who escaped from the Central Park Zoo after someone sabotaged his enclosure last year and lived for a year hunting rats in, like, urban New York City.
That's right. Flacco Shawshanked out of that cage, which, according to one article, was the size of a bus stop, and which he'd been living in for 12 years, and he started flying around Central Park. This is the kind of story we need right now.
Did he die after a year?
Yes, may he rest in peace. He lived as a free owl for a year, but then crashed into a building. And it turns out that he had also a lot of rat poison and pigeon herpes in his system, which might have been a factor too.
Mm, okay, yeah, that's sad.
But many iterations of Flacco would exist in New York City should humans disappear. So it'd be all these species and eroding buildings and plants and animals all coexisting and interbreeding and becoming this 22nd century novel ecosystem.
Wow. It's a neat idea to think about. That is a really wild what if.
Exactly. So this question about New York City without us is just one of many great responses to our latest call out for questions for our recurring Outside Inbox listener mailbag episode.
Yeah, perfect. I'm Nate Hedgie, here with Justine Paradise, and this is one of those special episodes where scientists everywhere hold their breath as the Outside In team answers your questions about the natural world. But this time, we asked you to send your what if questions. Speculative, not quite answerable questions. We got so many good ones that we're going to keep answering them in future episodes, but today we are going to start by answering just a couple of them. We asked our producer, Felix Poon, to tackle the first one for us. What's up, Felix?
So we got a couple of what-if questions on Instagram about the moon.
Okay.
Catherine from Portland, Oregon asked, what if the Earth had no moon? And Mandy from Lake Villa, Illinois asked, what if the Earth's moon was much larger?
Ooh.
So Nate, what do you think would happen if we just disappeared the moon?
No tides. It would be really dark at night.
Well, to answer this question, I spoke to Stefan Alexander. He's a theoretical physicist at Brown University. And without the moon, Stefan says things would be different.
Without a moon, the Earth's tilt will be destabilized, and therefore it will probably completely mess up the seasons.
Oh, what does he mean?
Okay, currently the Earth's axis is tilted at about a 23.5 degree angle, which is what gives us our seasons. But without a moon, sometimes the Earth could be a straight 90 degrees,
okay,
which would get rid of seasons completely. And then other times, it could just kind of lie on its side, which would make the poles burning hot and the equator freezing cold.
Oh, so we definitely need the moon.
Yeah, we definitely need the moon. And like you were saying before, the tides would be affected, but they wouldn't disappear completely because the sun's gravitational pull still would create a little bit of a tide.
Kind of like the tides you see in the Great Lakes. It's like a tiny little tide.
I did not know that.
Sorry, Midwestern kid.
And weaker tides would have an effect on wildlife, like sea turtles that lay their eggs with the tide, for example. Even land animals could be impacted.
Predators need a little bit of moonlight to hunt.
So some studies show that predators could have a harder time hunting prey, but other studies show just the opposite, that some predators do better with no moonlight.
Okay, so freaky seasons, tiny tides, no moonlight, no thank you. What about the other question? What would happen if the moon was bigger?
Yeah, Stefan says a lot could change. Low tides would be lower. Mm-hmm. High tides could be much higher.
You might have waves that are like, you know, as large as apartment buildings or something like that.
Whoa, like in Interstellar when they get crushed by that wave.
And Stefan says a heavier moon could make the Earth tilt even more, which could make seasonal extremes and weather more intense. And get this, the moon would either have to be faster, in which case the lunar calendar would speed up and we'd get full moons more often, or it would slowly get pulled in and crash into the Earth.
For the moon to remain in a stable orbit around the Earth, if it's more massive, it has to move faster.
Oh, like the movie Moonfall. That's terrible. So what you're saying is even freakier seasons, tremendous tides, and the absolute destruction of the Earth potentially. I want to stick with the moon that we have.
And there's a lot in the world that's aligned to the lunar cycle, whether it's just coincidence or not. Biologists have found the reproductive cycles of sea creatures aligned with the lunar cycle, for example. And there's even studies on the moon's impact on human sleep patterns and menstrual cycles, though the jury's still out on that one. At the end of the day, you know, we can try to imagine a moonless world or a bigger moon, but all we can really say is that our moon looms pretty large on life as we know it.
Just how much life depends on the moon. I mean, so much of the cycles of the moon modulates the physiology, actually, of living beings on Earth, including, I believe, humans.
So moon, very important. Perfect size. Don't need it bigger. Still want it. Keep it as is.
Exactly.
I really like that as Felix was answering this question for you, you just kept thinking of different sci-fi films that related to the various...
This is my go-to. I watch too many bad sci-fi movies.
But I feel like the reason that you kept doing that is that it speaks to the what-if setup is kind of how it feels like a lot of sci-fi probably starts out that way for the writer, you know?
Absolutely. I'm sure like a screenwriter sits down and like looks up and he's like, what if that moon just like crashed into Earth?
Right.
There we go. Good idea. Call up Gerard Butler, the actor who stars in that movie. He's kind of cheesy.
I look forward to your breakthrough sci-fi novel that you eventually write based on one of these what if questions.
These what-if questions also had us reaching out to very highly specific experts to answer them. That is definitely the case for our next question. Outside In editor Taylor Quimby answered this one for us with the help of Rebecca Lavoy, NHPR's director of podcasts. It's about climate change, and before you hear it, remember, to reach the targets of the Paris Agreement, climate experts say we need to keep the atmospheric CO2 concentration under at least 400 parts per million, or PPM for short. So here's David in Fairbanks, Alaska, with a question.
What if Earth's atmosphere reaches a CO2 concentration of 1,200 parts per million? My understanding is that this will be a critical tipping point for life on Earth. I'd like to know what changes in our behavior will be absolutely necessary for survival. Thanks.
Oof, that's dark.
Yeah, I know. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, they've outlined a few different climate futures, and the worst one is called SSP5. For you nerds out there, that's Shared Socioeconomic Pathway. But basically, this is the scenario that says, here's what emissions will look like if governments do literally nothing to curb fossil fuel usage.
Yeah, so this is like if nothing happens and everyone just ignores it, like nothing's going on, look the other way.
Yeah. In fact, it's actually if things get worse, like we use more coal than we do today.
Okay.
And in that scenario, there is a chance that we could see atmospheric carbon dioxide doubling, hitting the scary numbers that our caller mentioned, 1,200 parts per million or more. But ironically, here's the thing, we don't actually have a very precise picture of how much warming that would lead to.
currently worst case scenarios are dangerously understudied.
Who's that?
So this is Luke Kemp. He is a research affiliate at the Center for the Study of Existential Risk in Cambridge, England.
Like, who named that place?
The Doomsday Center. Luke says there isn't a lot of incentive to focus on these higher emission scenarios, for good reason in a lot of respects. But there is a fear that this much carbon dioxide would kick off feedback loops that raise average global temperatures 7, 10, I've seen 12 degrees Celsius. And that kind of worst case scenario would make for a
fairly silent, life depleted, hellish landscape made up of purple oceans and a slightly grin tinged sky as well.
Wow. That sounds apocalyptic.
It sounds like the sort of thing, if I saw it in a movie, I'd be like, this seems overdone.
It's like what a kid would do in a coloring book if they didn't have the right color crayons, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So for humans to survive, how would we have to adapt? Well, first, this world is much, much hotter. So you'd have to imagine we'd migrate to places like Canada, the Arctic, maybe even Antarctica. And we're not sure whether the soils in those places would be any good. So we would probably have to rethink food production.
The wackiest thing one can imagine is that we actually start relying upon other staple food sources, things like algae, seaweed, potentially even actually growing mushrooms en masse, as well as eating things like rats.
Okay.
Yeah.
Frankly, it sounds like just thinking less Western, you know what I mean?
It's true. These are all foods that we eat now. It's just, but they would become staples. They'd be replacing things like potatoes.
Yeah. I mean, the rats thing is a little far.
So Luke and I continued spitballing in our interview, and we talked about all sorts of things, you know, people living in bunkers, cybernetic technology to survive extreme heat, desalination plants becoming more common. But this is like science fiction territory, right?
Yeah.
And if you've seen Mad Max or The Road, you might think that humans would be at their absolute worst in this worst-case scenario. Luke actually disagrees.
I think that's unlikely, particularly based on my study of previous societal collapses. If anything, there's a good chance that you might even see more pro-social democratic forms of governance happening.
So there's your silver lining, Rebecca.
Yeah, it's like the Matrix, where everyone's kind of getting along and dancing in that underground bunker.
It's like the sexy part of the Matrix. You remember where they're like,
right,
it's raining and they're all like half naked? And
it's a rave, yeah, with those sweaters with holes in them.
Yeah. He pointed out that in a really, really catastrophic situation, you might see a return to sort of like hunter-gatherer societies. And all things being equal, those would, you know, benefit from having like good relationships between clans or groups or what have you.
I mean, has Luke ever met, though, people? I mean, it doesn't really seem to be like what we're like these days.
Well, there's actual studies that show after disasters, there is this like groundswell of pro-social behavior. I think the other thing to worry about is that, climate change and all these terrible things, like it increases pressure on, you know, social unrest, financial institutions. And so you also see a collapse. It's like if we survive the collapse, people would probably be pro-social, but first we have to survive the collapse. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, especially probably since we wouldn't have things like Facebook anymore. Just going to say.
Yeah, no, getting rid of Facebook would definitely help.
Yep. Talking to your actual neighbors.
But all of this, you know, while scientists agree that climate change is happening, there is a lot of uncertainty when we talk about these extreme hypotheticals. So I think, Rebecca, the most important thing that they can do is to push us to make changes so that that is all they will ever be, hypotheticals.
With better science, we can actually have better discussions about these worst case scenarios. Right now, people often revert to this doomsday talk because they can't rely upon good evidence and good studies.
So there you have it, another cheery outside inbox.
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe I'll practice and make some mushroom soup tonight, Taylor. So thanks a lot.
Nate, what do you think your role would be at the Center for the Study of Existential Risk? My job might be director of deep breathing techniques.
My job would be like the director of only thinking about things 6 inches in front of your face. That's what I've been trying to do anyway lately. Right. It's like, don't worry about the past. Don't think too far in the future. Just what's in the 6 inches in front of you. That's all you're going to worry about.
Co-chair of trying to only worry about what's under your control.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Which is increasingly not much. Okay. We still have a couple more questions on deck today. Coming up, we'll be pondering the mysteries of turtles and chickadees. But first, I want to remind you that you, too, can submit a question to the Outside Inbox. You can call our hotline and leave a voicemail. The number is 1-844-GO-OTTER. You can also record a voice memo and send it to us. Our email is outsidein@nhpr.org.
I live by routines, especially my same-day delivery routine with Shipt. Because when Sunday rolls around, I'm not scared. I got my shopper on the way with all my favorites. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com.
Save big money on protecting your garden now at Menards. Messina's Animal Stopper is a liquid repellent that prevents pesky animals from damaging your garden. Available in a convenient, ready-to-use bottle. It lasts for up to 30 days, regardless of weather and watering. Save big money on Messina's Animal Stopper at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Hey, this is Outside In. I'm Nate Hedgie, here with producer Justine Paradise. We are opening up our listener mailbag today, and for the rest of the show, we're going to be thinking about wildlife,
which is a pretty good theme for early spring, which is the time of recording.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure everyone listening knows, Nate, but you recently moved to a ranch in rural Montana and started raising pack goats. Am I right?
A ranch is a very big stretch of the word. Let's call it a log home on 5 acres of land in the Rocky Mountain front. And yes, we do have pack goats.
Not a joke.
which are two goats that carry your stuff in the backcountry. Was it impulsive to buy them? Yeah, it was. But do we love them? Yes, we do.
The, you know, your classic impulse pack goat purchase.
We've all been there, right, Justine?
We've all been there. I am curious if there are any early spring rhythms that have to happen with pack goats. Like, do you need to do any shearing? Like,
no, they're very resilient. I don't have to do anything with them. But when it comes to early spring, living out here, here's something I've noticed that's actually really cool. Is that right now we are in the middle of a snow goose migration.
Oh.
So we have literally thousands of snow geese flying over our home every day.
Wow.
Landing in the river, in the reservoir that's near us. Yesterday I saw an eagle chasing a flock of snow geese, and I was like, I pulled over. The eagle did not catch one, but I was just like, this is amazing. I feel like I am in the throes of spring right now.
Wow. That's like a wonder of the world level event.
Yeah, it's really cool.
That is lucky. I think early spring is one of my favorite times of year because it's so delicate. The peepers are coming out. There's tree flowers. Everything is very electric, I feel.
Do you know that that Tom Waits song? You can never hold back spring.
I think my new goal for any tracking session is to get you to sing Tom Waits at some point.
I like it. I'll accept that challenge as well.
One of the very early signs of spring here in Maine, where I live, is that the chickadees are starting to get some action.
Oh.
Black-capped chickadees are pretty widespread, and they're mostly permanent residents wherever they are. They don't migrate too much, which is highly relevant to our next question, which was submitted by a listener named Ange. Ange asks, do birds that are the same species have accents if they live in different regions?
That's a great question.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
Because obviously humans display regional accents. And
yep.
If you were to apologize to me, for instance, Nate, you're from the Midwest in British Columbia, what would you say?
I'd say sorry. I'm so sorry.
I'm so sorry. That's how I would say it.
Yeah. That's classic. Classic. I think that's the Canadian sneaking out, is the sorry versus sorry.
There we go. So to answer this one about birds, I talked to Chris Sturdy. He's a psychologist who studies birdsong at the University of Alberta in Canada.
But we fell into dialects by accident.
So about 10 years ago, Chris and a PhD student were researching black-capped chickadees. Nate, are you familiar with the typical chickadee song?
I know that one.
So that one's their alarm call. And then there's also another song that they have, and it's a two or three note song.
People characterize it as either a Phoebe or a cheeseburger.
Which can be both territorial or a mating song. It's sometimes described as, hey, sweetie. So at this time, Chris and his team were looking for acoustic markers in birdsong to see if there was a difference between dominant and subordinate birds.
Mm-hmm.
So they did an analysis of a bunch of recordings of chickadee songs.
Our dream was, or our prediction slash dream, was that we were going to put these in and then there would be like a cluster of birds that would be dominant and a cluster of birds that would be subordinate. And it'd be like, aha, it did it.
Instead, they got the data back and it did not reflect their hypothesis, which at first was a little discouraging.
I mean, this is why I and others always tell their students to not be afraid of the data. Because the data did not follow our predictions, or our predictions were not supported by the data. But because we were actually open to it after a bunch of head scratching, cursing, and all the rest, we figured it out. But it took a left turn into this whole idea of geography.
The issue was, these chickadees had been recorded in very different parts of Canada. And these different groups of birds had regional accents that were messing up the data.
Okay, so birds do have regional accents.
Yes, and it was known that other songbirds had regional dialects, so species like white-crowned sparrows or chaffinches in Scotland.
Wow.
But people thought that chickadees sang the same song across the North American continent, except for a couple isolated populations. So Chris and his student rallied, and they set off with a new focus, studying two groups of birds around 1,500 miles apart or so, and they tested them to see if those birds could discriminate between the different accents. And so it turns out that while the human ear couldn't pick up the differences, other chickadees sure could.
You know, that's their livelihood. They use songs for attracting a mate, defending a territory, communication, and it's, you know, highly biologically relevant.
It's like their whole job to distinguish between those songs.
So they could tell. They could tell. It's kind of like Western Canada doesn't have as strong of a quote-unquote Canadian accent as Eastern Canada. So I'm just imagining a bunch of these chickadees just going, A, 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 A.
Well, one of the things that their evidence suggested is that chickadees can hear how long they hold the notes in that Phoebe song.
Mm.
So you're not far off.
That's so cool.
And actually, funnily enough, that the isolated populations, one of them is off Cape Cod on Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket. And so I like to think that those birds have a bit of a Cape Cod accent.
What is a Cape Cod accent, by the way?
Oh, it's like chowda. That's
chowda.
The sort of
okay.
Caricature of a Cape Cod accent.
Classic.
We don't really know why birds have regional accents, but Chris explained that one reason might be because of the way that songbirds learn their songs.
Even though birds will copy the song patterns from their models, usually their fathers or another male living nearby, at least in temperate North American species, there might be slight errors in the copying. And then those errors are propagated through subsequent generations. And then that's thought to be one mechanism by which the dialects actually arise.
So it's kind of like a game of telephone.
A grand game of bird telephone.
Let's talk about another really cool moment in early spring. It's this event known among naturalists as Big Night. It'll be one of the first warmer nights in early spring. Ideal conditions are above 45 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe a little rainy, a little wet. And that's the kind of thing that gets all the frogs and all the salamanders and all the land in the mood. This can mean hundreds of thousands of amphibians hopping and crawling along in a single spring night. Getting to the spring ponds where they'll breed means crossing a road. And that leads us to our next question, answered again by our producer, Felix Poon.
Hey, so we got an email from Mariah in Lebanon, New Hampshire. And she tells this story about how her mom had just seen a deer get hit on the road. She pulled over, turned her hazards on, and called 911. And while she waited, she watched the deer, which was still alive, get hit two more times by different vehicles before it finally died.
That's terrible.
Yeah, so she contacted New Hampshire's Department of Transportation about getting one of those yellow deer crossing signs put up.
Mm-hmm.
But they basically said no.
Really? Why?
Well, because there actually isn't much evidence that these signs do anything. I mean, do you slow down when you see one of those wildlife signs?
No, I slow down when I actually see the wildlife.
Yeah.
I kind of honestly just ignore them, unless it's cool wildlife. Like, I remember when I was in Alaska, you'd see, like, caribou crossing.
So anyway, Mariah's question is,
are there any effective solutions to wildlife collisions being explored in New Hampshire?
In other words, if we're not putting up signs, then what are we doing?
You did a whole outside-in episode about this, and if I remember correctly, a lot of it was about building wildlife crossings, right? Like, is New Hampshire building any animal-friendly infrastructure?
Well, I talked to Sandy Houghton. She's a wildlife diversity biologist at the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, we do have crossings for wildlife in New Hampshire. We just don't see them because they're underneath the road.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, Sandy says there's over 20,000 points in New Hampshire where roads go over a stream or a river.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these are bridges where wildlife can simply pass underneath. Others might look like a normal road to your average driver. But underneath it, there's a culvert, which is basically a water tunnel. Granted, most culverts aren't designed to be used by wildlife, but when it's time to fix an old culvert, biologists like Sandy often try to get the transportation department to replace them with ones that wildlife can cross through.
Are these culverts like big enough for deer to walk through?
So a lot of culverts are typically used by turtles, salamanders, and fish.
Yeah.
They do make culverts big enough for some mammals, though.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of one in Stratford. They made it to mimic a natural river habitat so that fish can pass through. But it's also got these bigger boulders that bobcats and black bears can use to cross and stay dry.
That's pretty cool.
This culvert's not tall enough for deer, though. But there's another culvert in Newmarket that is tall enough for deer. And there's other culvert projects in the pipeline that'll also accommodate deer.
Is there anything that like people, just like regular people, can do as well?
Yeah, so Sandy recommended a website called Taking Action for Wildlife, which has a bunch of suggestions for things you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like donating land for habitat conservation or reporting wildlife and roadkill through a citizen science website run by UNH. There's also these salamander crossing brigades. The Harris Center for Conservation Education organizes some every springtime when salamanders, toads, and frogs are trying to get to vernal pools to breed. Basically, volunteers go out at night and carry them safely across the road.
That sounds pretty fun, actually. I'd like to do that.
You know, Nate, I too have thought that helping out amphibians like that sounds extremely fun. And this question actually inspired me to finally get my act together. So this spring, I signed up as a volunteer for Big Night in Maine.
Whoa.
I adopted a little road site, and I'm going to go hopefully save some salamanders.
That sounds so much fun.
I will keep people posted. Maybe I'll post on our Instagram and our newsletter when I go out and let people know how it goes.
Great idea. Get some of those shots of them salamanders. I want to see them. This episode of Outside In was produced and reported by the whole team, Felix Poon, Taylor Quimby, and Justine Paradise. It was edited by Taylor Quimby and Rebecca Lavoie, and HPR's Director of Podcasts. Music in this episode came from Walt Adams, Black Sona, Katori Walker, Bizou, Young Community, Diamond Ortiz, Bright Arm Orchestra, Kevin MacLeod, Telsonic, and Proly R. Recordings of Chickadees and Peepers came from freesound.org, from Wild Ear One, Tim Kahn, KV Garlic, and Raban 625. Outside In is a production of NHPR.
I live by routines, especially my same-day delivery routine with Shipt. Because when Sunday rolls around, I'm not scared. I got my shopper on the way with all my favorites. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com.
Saving money on protecting your garden. Now at Menards. Messina's Animal Stopper is a liquid repellent that prevents pesky animals from damaging your garden. Available in a convenient, ready-to-use bottle. It lasts for up to 30 days, regardless of weather and watering. Save big money on Messina's Animal Stopper at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money.